Yeah, it could be.
We're going to go ahead and start. I'd like to welcome you all out tonight. My name's Robert Burns. I'm the chairman of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. We'll go around and introduce ourselves. There's a few people that are going to be here, but they're just a little late. And then I'll go over the procedure, how we conduct our meeting. So, Jim, if you'd introduce yourself.
My name is Jim Gaskill. I'm from South Weber, and I'm an at-large representative.
Paul Cowley, I represent the Forest Service.
Craig Van Tassel from Camas, Sportsman.
John Wall from Riverdale, Public at Large.
Jeffrey Hicks, South Weber, at large.
Russ Lawrence from Ogden, Public at Large.
Bryce Thurgood Perry, at large.
Ann Neville from Farmington, non-consumptive.
And Justin Doling, I'm the regional supervisor, and I serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member of the council.
And again, I'm Robert Burns. I'm from Centerville, and I represent the public at large. If you join me and turn the ringers off on your cell phones or put them on vibrate, we can hopefully get through our meeting without too much interruption. Our general procedure is that our purpose here is to gather public input from the public on wildlife management, policy rules, and regulations. The council will then deliberate and make recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board sets the policy for all protected wildlife in Utah. We have an agenda at the back, and there's some informational items back there. We'll have a presentation from the division or the person proposing the action item, and then we'll have questions from the public, then we'll have questions from the council, then we'll have comments from the public, and try to confine your questions and your comments in those periods. The questions come first, then the comments. After we're done with the public comments, we'll close the meeting off to the public, and we'll have comments from the council, and then we'll deliberate and have motions and decision on the agenda item. If you'd like to comment, not just questions, but if you want to comment during the comment period for the public, please fill out a blue card. They're back there on the table. Then I can know who to call up in the order that I've received them. And when you come up to speak to the council, if you would speak give your name and your address to the microphone, we can get that recorded for the minutes. And the minutes are available as a recording and transcription on the division webpage later. So, I think that's all there. Okay, so the chair would entertain a motion to approve the agenda for April 18th, 2012. There, I did place a agenda at each seat for the council members that shows the current agenda, not what was in your packet.
So moved. Second.
I have a little bit of discussion I'd like to enter into on regarding the agenda.
Yes.
I would really like to be educated on how the agenda is formulated, who does it, and why. In particular, I'm concerned about what I don't want to develop as a trend to have certain items only presented to a particular region, and I understand that can happen, and it has happened in the past on occasion. But I know that there are at least a couple of RAC members, not in this region, who who have expressed their feeling that only the RAC that's affected by a proposal should vote on it. And I strongly disagree with that, and I would not like to see that trend expanded. If I'm elected as a representative, I think that I'm entitled and obligated to research and find out what that proposal is about and should be able to vote. Just because I don't live in the southern region or the southeast region doesn't mean I don't know anything about it. In fact, I hunt deer and turkeys in the southeast region and have for 20 years. And I think many of the people on the Wasatch Front hunt off the Wasatch Front and should have equal representation. So that's my comment.
And I saw the same email, and I think it was pretty much universally contradicted by the chairs that, management of certain units is definitely of interest to everyone within the state. Now, I believe there was a 9-mile moose management plan that was on the southeast region's agenda that's not on ours. Sometimes I do see specific agenda items like that. So I'm not sure. Maybe we should see that, though. Maybe we do have some interest in that southeast region moose management plan. So,
well, I'm not so sure about that. It could be, but I don't understand how the agenda gets set up in the first place. So maybe that's one of my problems.
Yeah, Stacy sets up the agenda and it goes out with the packet, but there is a certain time where to get things on the agenda have to be available to get them out on the agenda. So,
and who, let's say a member of this RAC wanted something on the agenda, could we do that, and if so, how?
If it was an action item, we would have to make sure that we get the proper public notice.
Well, of course. I would not ask it to be an action item until it had been discussed, but I'm just talking about getting it on the agenda for information item.
If it was an informational item, I think we can add that without a lot of advance notice, just as long as we can get it on the agenda for the meeting. I think, was it 24 hours, Justin? Yeah, it's 24 hours in advance. If it's an informational item, we're not going to vote on an informational item, and we're not going to pass a recommendation on that's binding.
Of course not.
Okay, so.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, there is a large schedule of how things come around through the process, and they try to work them into the meetings that we're having, so.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, okay. Any additional discussion? Okay, we have a motion and a second to approve the agenda for April 18th, 2012. All in favor, would you say aye and raise your hands?
Aye.
Aye.
9 in favor, 0 opposed. Okay, now the December 14th, 2011 minutes. We did have a few emails back and forth initially. Are there any additional amendments to the December 14th, 2011 minutes? Seeing none, do we have a motion?
Did I miss something? I didn't get any corrections. I don't
Paul,
remember getting any corrections.
You sent me an email right afterwards, didn't you?
No, I can't.
Okay.
Okay, well, I'll move that we accept them anyway, as corrected or amended.
It seems to me like the one correction that we had was getting Justin's position corrected, because we had him listed as an acting instead of the regional supervisor, which he was at that time. So I think that was the only correction I saw in it.
Okay, we have a motion to approve the minutes as amended.
I'd second that.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
9 in favor, 0 opposed. It has been quite a while since our last meeting. hopefully y'all received my email on the Wildlife Board's actions. Are there any additional questions on that? Okay, I'll turn it over to Justin for his regional update.
You want to give a Wildlife Board update or?
I emailed it to you.
Okay, great. Okay, I'd like to start out just by introducing a couple new employees we have here in the region. Riley Peck is our sensitive species biologist and primarily focusing in on sensitive species here in the northern region. He started about 3 months ago, maybe 4 months ago.
Is he here?
I don't believe Riley is here. Stand up if you're here, Riley. Nope, he's not here. The second individual is Phil Tuttle. And Phil Tuttle has replaced Candace Hutchings, who was our aquatic invasive species biologist. So he'll be focusing in on our quagga mussel prevention effort. And so Phil's new to the region, and he started about a week ago. So moving into our section updates, our law enforcement section is just completing some in-service training. They do a lot of training in law enforcement, and they're just putting on some final touches in their in-service training. They're also updating their data management system. They have a system that's right in their vehicle now where they can enter and log citations. They can also do background checks and different things. And so they're in the process of updating that system. And they also wanted to announce that an individual by the name of Joe Murray, was an individual that had a mountain goat permit on Willard Peak. That individual shot more than one mountain goat. He pled guilty to that and paid restitution in the tune of $12,000 and lost his big game hunting privileges for 20 years as a result of that. So moving on to our habitat section, the projects that our habitat folks put in place last spring and last fall are really benefiting tremendously off this spring moisture. Things are looking really, really good. They continue to do a lot of shrub plantings, and in fact they're looking for help. If anybody here on the rack or in the audience would like to volunteer to help plant shrubs, our habitat section is looking for some help here over the next couple of weekends. They're also busy working on power and wind farm proposals, basically under reviewing the potential wildlife impacts associated with those proposals. And then they're looking at expanding some lop and scatter activities where they go out and thin out juniper juniper and pinyon that are encroaching into sagebrush as a way to try to enhance mule deer habitat. So they'll be looking at doing some of those. Also expanding fishing access on the Weber River. They've extended that access by about a mile. So we have a new stretch of the Weber River that's open to anglers. And the wildlife maintenance crew, we have a crew that we hire each year that goes around and does a lot of maintenance work on our WMAs. That crew's on board now, and they'll start to do some of our routine maintenance activities on the WMAs. As far as our wildlife section goes, they're busy counting sharp-tailed grouse and sage grouse. This time of the year, the birds come together and form what's known as a lek. Our biologists go out and count those leks, and so I would encourage anybody on the rack that wants to spend some time out in the field and has never done that before to contact Randy Wood and see if we can't make an arrangement to get you out on a lek count. They're also finishing up our deer spring classifications. It looks like deer survival was good this winter, somewhere between 12 and 20% loss, so a pretty good winter for deer, and hopefully this spring moisture will continue on and will provide good forage for the upcoming summer. They're also getting ready and geared up for the winter range assessments, where they actually go out and inspect the range, look how the range fared over the course of the winter, and also look for any mortality in big game. And then there's a sharp-tailed grouse transplant that's occurring here in Box Elder County, and they're currently moving sharp-tailed from Box Elder County to Antelope Island to develop a nursery flock for future transplants. In our aquatic section, the guys are working busy on a fluvial fish study and what a fluvial fish is a fish that lives in the main stem of the Weber River or the main stem of any large river, but uses the small tributaries to spawn. And what they found is that we have a remnant population of fluvial cutthroat that run anywhere from 20 to 22 inches in the main stem, But some of the tributaries that they run up have been impeded with different road crossings, and so they're looking at trying to remedy some of those barriers that would allow those fluvial fish to continue to spawn in the higher reaches of the tributaries. They're also looking at a least chub introduction out to Locomotive Springs. They're looking at also a Yellowstone cutthroat restoration project on Johnson Creek, which is a small tributary to the Snake River that comes out of northwestern Utah. And they're telling me right now that fishing is really good on the Ogden River, Lost Creek Reservoir, Willard, Pine View, and their sense is that most of their warm water fisheries will also be picking up in the next couple of weeks. So if you enjoy fishing, get out and definitely hit some of those hot spots. They're also looking at doing some rotenone treatments, and the environmental work is wrapping up for those rotenone treatments. So hopefully if the environmental assessments are approved, those rotenone treatments will take place. And then, as I indicated, Phil Tuttle is our new aquatic invasive species biologist, and that program is just starting to get geared up. So we're basically moving out our spray rigs. We've got some agreements set up with Parks and Rec to help decontaminate boats, and also looking at some of the port of entries to see if we can't tighten up our boundaries here when it comes to transporting these invasive species. The last section is outreach. The outreach section is busily putting the final touches on our Hardware Ranch management plan, and hopefully the RAC will see that management plan, preview of that management plan at the next meeting. The outreach section wanted me to remind you that you can subscribe to the fishing reports. So if you go online to our website, you can actually subscribe, and it's all free. And if you subscribe to our fishing reports, you receive a free weekly update of where the fishing is good in the state. And currently, here in the northern region, we have about 2,400 subscriptions to that little piece of fishing information. So take advantage of that free service, especially if you like to fish. Get on, sign up for those free subscriptions, and you just get an automatic email update when they come out. Apparently, at 1 o'clock this morning, a new state record wiper was caught at Willard Reservoir. Don't have all the details, but it looks like it weighed in at 10 pounds, 2 ounces. So that's my update. I'll take any questions from the RAC if they have any.
Thank you, Justin. I did skip over one of my notes here. I'd like to recognize Ernie Perkins. He's represents the Northern Region on the Wildlife Board. Sitting right there in the front row by Anise, and I believe Alan Clark, the assistant director, is back in the back. Nice to see you out, Alan. So we'll go ahead and move on to item number 5, Deer Management Plan Amendment and General Season Deer Permit Recommendations for 2012. I would like to say that there were a lot of numbers kicking around early, so the recommendations that Anise makes today are the recommendations from the division, and pay close attention, because some of the early stuff out there was definitely not what is the final result.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, RAC members. I'll be presenting the whole presentation is the buck bulls once in a lifetime, but I'll stop at the portion for the general season and then address any issues, and then you guys can vote on that, and then I'll proceed with the rest of the presentation. So initially we'll start with general season deer permits and amendments to the statewide plan. I always like to show some harvest data before we start our general season, just to kind of show people how many bucks are being harvested in the state and how that compares with the long-term trend. So this is a data set that goes back to 2001, so basically 10 years worth of data, that shows harvest, you know, being around 28,000 at the high end and around 18,000 at the low end, and it fluctuates quite a bit annually, depending on a lot of different things, one of which is the fawn crop the year previous, weather conditions during the hunt, all kinds of things affect that. The last few years, though, is probably lower than average just because we've been cutting permits gradually every year for the last few years and have gone from our total of 97,000 permits to 87,000 permits last year. So we've cut about 10,000 permits so far in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. And that explains a lot of why we have less of a harvest. This graph basically shows fawn production. So how many fawns make it from basically birth to 6 months of age compared to the number of does in the population. So it's what we call our fawn-to-doe ratio. And then as you can see, it fluctuates as well. A lot of what affects fawn-to-doe ratio, well, the biggest thing that probably affects fawn-to-doe ratio is, you know, what the habitat looks like and, you know, how many you're able to carry. That 2002 dip was the height of the drought. We've kind of had a little bit better conditions, but also have had quite a few droughty summers in between as well. So that's why you see those fluctuations. Usually, a good rule of thumb in Utah anyway, is if you're above 60 fawns per 100 does, usually you've got a growing population. If you're right at 60, you're probably stable. If you're below 60, you're usually declining. Again, there are exceptions to that, but on average, that's kind of what it plays out to be. So as you can see, at least currently, we're probably stable. We probably grew a little bit the last couple of years, and now it's on a declining trend. Okay, this is a graph showing our average buck-to-doe ratio statewide. These are on general season units only, on public land general season units. I've put there two yellow dotted lines. One indicates the old plan where we managed for a minimum of 15 bucks per 100 does, and the higher one is under the new plan we managed for a minimum of 18 bucks per 100 does. And I just wanted to show that it would require a permit reduction to get above that 18 bucks per 100 does, and thus, you know, some of the discussions we'll be having are geared around that. So jumping into our recommendations, basically, as you recall, you know, a while back we did an amendment to the plan where we went to 30 units on general season, and where we set a statewide objective on general season units of 18 to 25. Since then, the Wildlife Board has given us direction to maybe look at these units specifically and try to recommend different objectives on different units. This would be in an effort to not reduce opportunity so much. So this, if we do this, and this is what we are recommending, it would require an amendment to the plan. And if you agree to what we are recommending, you would be amending the plan automatically, basically. It wouldn't require two different actions. So what we're recommending is basically placing general season units into one of two objective categories. We split it into two categories, and I'll explain a little bit how we came about those. But basically, some would be in a 15 to 17 category and some 18 to 20 category. Still maintaining them as general season units, so we're still hunting these units to provide opportunity more than antler quality, I guess. But we do have two tiers, one that may have more bucks on it, the 18 to 20, and one that would provide a lot more opportunity, the 15 to 17. Having said that, the way we came up with these is basically, first, when we were given the direction to start looking at this, we had some internal meetings where we gathered all the biologists and managers and kind of, you know, had a brainstorming session, you know, where should we be, what kind of things. And we kind of roughly sketched out what we have here now. And then what we did is after that meeting, we asked the regions to go out to the public and kind of get a feel of what, if they think this is a good approach. And most of the input we got that this, you know, this is a good approach to go as far as general season units are concerned. So after we figured out that we're going to have a two-tier system, we needed to figure out, you know, how we would determine which units fell into what objective. And basically the way this was the same meeting where we did this. We again brainstormed and tried to figure out, you know, what units should fall into the lower objective and what units should fall into the higher objective. And the way we approached it is units that are harder to maintain a high buck to doe ratio should fall into the lower one, because it would require a much higher cut in permits to maintain that high buck to doe ratio. These are units that are primarily public land, have good access, are well roaded, and basically they're units where it's easier to harvest a buck. Thus, if it's easy to harvest a buck, you'd have to cut permits a lot. You'd have to make a bigger cut to get to 18 bucks per 100 does. So we thought these would be good units to maintain at the lower buck to doe ratio. So that's kind of how we approach it. And then inversely, those units that have not very good access are either primarily private land or have some wilderness attributes to them, so they're not well roaded. You have to hike in to harvest your buck. We could maintain those units at 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does without having to cut permits so much, just because access is limiting. So that's the way we approached it. And then again, we asked our regional folks to take that out and see how it flies. And then we use that information to put the units in the objectives we have. Even though we set these criteria, the way we broke them out initially, internally, actually had more units going into the 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does. But as you can see here, 16 units are actually in the higher objective, 18 to 20, and 14 units are in the 15 to 17. And that's a product of our regional folks going out and gaining the regional input. Some of the folks in the region said, you know, yeah, we understand this is a public land unit, we understand it's well eroded, but we still want 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does, knowing full well that it would require an additional cut in permits. So in any case, this is how they broke out, both, you know, from the sidelines we put on them and the input we got from the public. And most of that input was done fairly informally through open houses and other things of that nature. Okay, now we've got two tiers. We kind of figured out which units fall into what objective. Now we need to figure out how many permits go on each of these units. So basically, what we wanted to do is, in the past, you know, we've always maintained between 15 and 25, but we've always been on the lower end. So as a starting point, we wanted to shoot for the middle point. So on 15 to 17 units, we wanted to recommend permits that would get us around 16 instead of shooting for the lower point. And similarly, on the 18 to 20 units, we wanted to recommend a permit number that would get us more to that 19 number. So keeping that in mind, what we did is we used, since hunters afield is a fairly sketchy number when you hunt on a regional basis, because folks can hop from unit to unit, we didn't use hunters afield as a starting point. What we did use is harvested bucks on each unit. So that information is much more solid. We know that this buck was harvested on this unit. And then what we did is we applied the success rates back to that harvest, got the number of permits, and then added additional to that those permits that usually get sold but never get used. And it's usually between 13 and 15 permits, 15% of the permits annually, people buy them but never go hunting. So that's where that's how we got our starting permit numbers on each unit. So that three-year average of bucks harvested, applying the success rate, and then applying the number of hunters that don't hunt, gives you a number of permits that was on this, that basically was on any given unit to achieve the current buck doe ratio on that unit. So we had a starting point. And then from that, we increase or decrease permits. So say it was a unit that was going to be in the objective 15 to 17, and it was at 16 already. So we didn't recommend any increases on the units such as that. If it was on the low end, if it was 13 or 14, we would reduce permits to get to that 16, and so on. And the formula we used to come up with that number was based on about 10 years of data, looking at all different success rates at all different buck doe ratios, because as those that work with the data a lot realize that as you increase buck to doe ratio, success rates increase as well. So you actually have to cut permits more and more to achieve a higher buck to doe ratio. It's not a linear relationship. So we use this formula to apply to each unit. And then we did limit ourselves on the number of permits we increased, just so we stayed on the conservative side. We did not increase any unit by more than 10%, even though it may have warranted it, just to make sure we're not. But we did not limit ourselves on decreases. So if a unit was way below buck doe ratio objective, we cut as many permits as we needed to get to that objective as quickly as possible. So this is basically how it played out. This information is in a pamphlet in the back, and all of you should have it, so I won't belabor the, but I do have them on a slide if you need to go back to any of them. But basically, I've got them here in alphabetical order and by highest objective to lowest objective. And I'll breeze through them quickly, and then I'll go to the summary slide. But if you do want to go back to any of them after this presentation is done, we can certainly do that. So given what I've said, if what we are recommending today, amending the plan to these two objectives for general season unit, is not adopted, we could revert right back to the plan as it exists, where we already have a statewide objective of 18 to 25. So that's an option, and I wanted to make sure everybody realized that. So this would be our recommendation, basically. If the unit split is the way we've recommended it, we could have 86,500 permits statewide. It's only a reduction of 500 permits from last year. But keep in mind, we did reduce permits 7,000 this year, and then thousands of permits before that in subsequent years. So even though it does look like a slight reduction, it's actually quite a big reduction from where we were, you know, say 5 years ago. An additional thing that we did, besides having the mix of units with different objectives, is we changed the split of weapon types. In the past, the way it was is there was a set amount of archery permits, 16,000 was taken out, and then rifle and muzzle loader basically went out, were coming out of the same pool, so they came out proportional to how many people wanted them. So what we did was with this is to increase the number of permits. We basically made the split 60-20-20. So 60% go to rifle hunters, 20% to archers, and 20% to muzzleloader hunters. And this is the same split we use on our limited entry already. And we feel that it's a good split that provides enough opportunity in the rifle, but increases the number of permits slightly because you're pushing some into the archery and the muzzleloader as well. So with that split, what we end up with is 17,300 permits into archery, so a slight increase from what it was in the past, but keep in mind they have to hunt on a unit-by-unit basis now. They do not hunt statewide. Rifle permits were reduced slightly from 58,000, quite a bit actually, about 6,000 permits, but 51,900 total. And then muzzleloader permits went up slightly, again 17,300, so they're the same as archery permits because it's the same percentage. Now, if a recommendation on any unit is modified, obviously, like if any of the units that we recommended be 15 to 17 were bumped up to 18, 20, the total number of permits obviously would change because we would have to reduce permits further. And we need to keep that in mind. And this is not anything that is not doable. We just need to make sure that you know that if units are changed, that the total number will change as well. So, now, if the proposed objectives is not adopted, so if we go back to the plan as it stands, all units in the state revert to 18 to 25, we would have to cut roughly another 6,000, almost 6,800 permits. So, that's providing we go 18 to 25 statewide. And the split is there, so basically it's still we went with a 60-20-20 split because it does provide a little bit more opportunity. So it would be around 16,000 permits for archers, about 48,000 for a rifle, and around 16,000 for muzzleloaders. Okay, given all this information I've given you, there's one more little piece. So because we're hunting on a unit-by-unit basis, when we looked at the data, we've noticed that there will be units where archers do not prefer to hunt. So these units will probably go under-prescribed in the drawing and will be remaining over the counter. And they may not even sell through the archery season. So to deal with that and to avoid loss of opportunity and revenue, we decided to basically roll those permits over. So basically what it does is if there are muzzleloader permits available after the drawing is done, they would become available over the counter through the archery season. Once the archery season closes, those permits become muzzleloader permits September 17th. So muzzleloaders can buy them over the counter. And then if they remain available still after the muzzleloader season, they become any weapon permit.
I think you said muzzleloader to start, but you meant archery permit.
Yeah, right? Archery become muzzleloader, and then muzzleloader become rifle. Sorry if I misspoke. So yeah, so basically this in this way we can assure that all the permits get sold, opportunity still remains, and then revenue is not compromised either. The beauty of this system is even though some of the muzzleloader and the rifle weapon types have a little bit higher success rate, it basically, if success rate is higher, you'll harvest a few more bucks, it will affect buck-doe ratio, and you will adjust the permits accordingly until you get that equilibrium. So it would reduce permits slightly, but it will still be more permits than there would be if those permits went unsold. And with that, that's basically our recommendation for general season. And thank you, and glad to answer any questions.
Okay, so now we will have questions from the public on the presentation for the basic change in management plan. For Anise. Is there anyone from the public who'd like to ask a question from Anise? Seeing none, council?
Yes.
Jim.
First of all, as a review for some of us, when do you take those fawn counts?
The fawn to doe ratios are done post-hunt season, so usually it's the month of November.
So by then the fawns are...
are about 6 months old.
And they still subject to a lot of predation by coyotes?
Not a whole lot until winter hits. Winters, coyotes can get fawns in the winter, usually.
Okay. Are the buck to doe and fawn to doe counts taken on private land or public land?
They're taken on both, but at least when we were on managing on a region basis, we only used the public land classifications to set objectives on the unit, on any region. Now it's on a unit by unit basis, so it doesn't really matter because that unit encompasses all that private land. So most of the counts are done on public land, but there are units that are predominantly private land, and you can't avoid having some classifications be private land.
Okay. Why? I wasn't quite understanding why you limited the number of increases, but not the number of decreases. It seems like it would go both ways.
Yeah. So basically, what we're trying to do is not be on the conservative side as far as getting to buck-to-doe ratios, but not drop them too quickly either. So we wanted to get to objectives so buck-to-doe ratios would rise quickly. But on a lot of units where we might be slightly above, we just limited ourselves to 10% to see how, so we could bring it down slowly.
Okay. Then I had a couple of questions on this last...
And that mainly comes from a lot of our limited entry units. We do the same thing, just so it's not a market increase any given year.
Okay. And then explain, if I have an archery tag and it rolls over, or the remaining archery tags that are rolled over and become muzzleloader tags, they still have to abide by all the muzzleloader dates and rules, correct?
Yeah, so basically they have to hunt during the muzzleloader season.
And in the unit?
Right.
In the applicable unit.
Yeah, exactly.
And same... when they roll, if they were to roll
exactly.
over any weapon.
Yeah.
Okay. Once again, if you would explain to me
whether buck to doe ratios, increasing or decreasing them, is a substantial benefit to the overall deer herd.
No, obviously all of these things are only going to affect the buck hunting itself. As far as populations are concerned, having a few more bucks or a few less bucks is not going to affect population growth.
Okay, thank you.
John Cavett.
Anise, I was wondering if you could clarify for me. You mentioned that the 10-year average is about 13 to 15% of permits go unused. Does that mean that they're not successful, or does that mean they just never get into the field?
They never hunt.
So do you expect that number or that percentage to decline as we reduce these number of permits?
It may decline slightly, but basically we had 87,000 permits last year, and it was about that. So it shouldn't change a whole lot. I think a lot of people just busy these days. They buy a permit intending to go and never go.
Okay. Thank you.
Bryce Thurgood.
Anise, do you is it taking a lot more staff or time to go out and count now we're unit by unit basis?
No, it sounds like we're going unit by unit, and it's a great big thing, but we've always managed on a unit basis. We just hunted on a regional basis. So the data collection is exactly the same as we've done it in the past. The only difference will be is the harvest data will be a little bit more accurate, because now we don't have to ask people where they hunted. We already know where they hunted, so we just ask them whether they harvested or not. So that's the only difference, and that doesn't require our staff to do anything different.
Craig Van Tassel.
Yeah, I'd like you to explain the resident versus non-resident. It was my understanding at one time for every 5 resident permits, there was a non-resident permit offered. I just don't understand how you come up with those.
The rule is 10% is the way we try to do it, but it does round up. So if you're limited to 5, it would be 4 and 1. But if you have 10, it would be 9 and 1. So it's a 10% rule, but we round up when it's 5.
Paul.
Anise, when we do the counts on bucks per doe, what's the margin of error on those counts? How accurate are
you know
the
what?
Counts?
It varies a lot from unit to unit, depending on how many sample units you get. So in on some units, you may get a big group, and then there's a larger variance around that. But if you get a good representative of the unit, you know, it can be plus or minus 2 bucks per 100 does. Okay. Usually, it's erring on the higher end, because usually undercount bucks rather than overcount them.
Thank you.
Any additional questions for Anise from the council? Okay, seeing none, we're going to go into the public comment phase. I did forget, I'm a little rushed today. Our vice chair, John Cavett, is going to run the timer. If you're representing a group, I'll give you 5 minutes for your comments. If you're representing yourself, you'll get 3. He'll try to give you a little high sign when you're getting close. Just kind of keep an eye on him, and we'll go ahead. And Jerry Hill.
You tell him all I know. Yeah, my name is Jerry Hill. I'm from West Bentonville, Utah.
Just move up a little closer, Jerry.
Talking loud enough? Here we go. Do we need to turn it up more?
They're perfect when you're closer.
Okay. Jerry Hill, West Bountiful, and I'm representing the United Wildlife Cooperative. First off, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address the RAC. I also would like to thank the division for their hard work and diligence on behalf of sportsmen and wildlife in our state. You're the ultimate stewards of our resources, and we acknowledge your contributions and expertise in regards to wildlife. As you consider buck-to-doe ratio objectives and their consequences, we ask that you keep a few things in mind. Hunter retention and recruitment is lower than it has ever been in Utah. Schools no longer close for the opening of the deer hunt, and many of our neighbors frown on the idea of hunting in general. We urge you to be cautious about adopting a management strategy that further reduces hunting participation. We believe this to be counterproductive, as it does nothing for the biological health of our herds or overall population numbers, and only hurts our sport as we lose more participants. The single largest constituency for prudent wildlife management is the hunting community. Reducing tags to increase buck-to-doe ratios only does a disservice to this group and undermines its long-term viability, whether the hunters themselves realize it or not. We have heard many times about the great hunting in Colorado. We hear about their high buck-to-doe ratios. What we don't hear about is that since raising buck-to-doe ratio objectives to current levels back in 1999 and drastically cutting tags, the number of deer hunters that apply for deer tags in Colorado on an annual basis has been reduced by half. And overall, deer numbers have not improved. In fact, populations continue to decline in many portions of the state, and they continue to search for answers just as we do. They also have many hunters that are dissatisfied with management plans and are calling for higher ratios and deeper tag cuts just as we do. We hear some hunters say that they would prefer to sit out for several years so that when they finally do draw a tag, they will have a great chance to harvest a mature buck. But we already have those types of units to hunt in Utah in the form of limited entry and premium limited entry units. The complaint then becomes the wait is too long. It seems we want our cake and to eat it too sometimes. As this trend continues in Utah and across the West, we will continue to see our hunting heritage come under fire, and it too may become extinct as we lose more of our hunting constituency. We urge you to keep our general units as opportunity friendly as possible so that our youth can stay involved and be able to draw tags on a regular basis, and so that families can continue to hunt together as much as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Next card is Dan Wilhelm, but you didn't check if you wanted to speak or not. Do you? Okay, come on up.
I'm Dan Wilhelm from North Logan. I represent myself. I love to deer hunt. I go to work to make my mortgage payment and to hunt. There's a lot of people that do that, and we love it. We'd like to see more deer. The SFW had a plan to plant Smithfield Dry Canyon with, you know, a new habitat, chain it. The winter range is pretty much gone. And there's a gentleman, you know, with the DNR named Ron. I don't know his last name. Anyways, the project didn't go through because the plants were not, they didn't survive the winter. Anyways, so last year they were supposed to start chaining, didn't happen. So now we got postponed to spring. Now it's not going to happen. Now Ron's saying, you know, he's got bad health. I understand that. My hat's off to Ron. We hope he can get better. Why does the state not give some assistance to Ron so that we can get something happening? So, you know, the SFW got the coyotes. So hopefully the deer numbers rise. Now we just need a little more habitat up there to support the deer. But if we keep waiting, it's not going to support them. You know, so that's my question, is why can't we get some assistance for him? The other question is if the deer do go, you know, we're on a trend, we're out. 10 years, we're out of deer hunting if something doesn't change. Elk hunting's the same, it's going downhill. Some areas, some counties, it's going up. The moose hunt is going downhill. My question is, what are we going to hunt down the road if there's nothing to hunt? Anyways, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, let me try to answer your first question. Unfortunately, Ron did suffer some health issues, and since then we've sat down with Scott Walker, his immediate supervisor, and we've tried to revamp the way we're prioritizing projects here in the region. So I want to reaffirm that Ron's back in good health. He's online, and my desire is that we'll start to see good projects come out of the northern region, particularly on your property and other public and private lands throughout the region.
Cole Knighton, you didn't Yeah, you weren't sure if you wanted to speak. Do you want to speak to the council? All right. I will just read your card. Number one, how about providing more deer-related projects for dedicated hunters? Seems like most projects are related to the fisheries. Give us some habitat projects. And number two, control coyotes. Yes, but what is being done about habitat? So there are many pieces to this puzzle. Don't let big money decide. You have biologists use their logic and science, not profit. Thank you for your comment. And Zeke Marshall.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Zeke Marshall. I'm speaking on behalf of the Utah Bowman's Association. The Utah Bowman's Association applauds the efforts of the Wildlife Board and the Division of Wildlife Resources in their efforts to restructure the general season buck-to-doe ratio objectives. Over the last couple of years, we have seen that Utah's hunters are split almost evenly as to whether they want more trophy quality units versus more opportunity units. We believe that the DWR's recommendations reflect these views. Thus, the Utah Bowman's Association supports the DWR recommendations as presented. Thank you.
Thank you, Zeke. I don't have any additional blue cards. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak to the agenda item? Come on up. Just make sure you fill out a blue card for me, okay?
I will. My name is Mike Schultz. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak. As I've thought about the issue, I realize that in order to get people to hunt and to enjoy hunting, you have to have the opportunity for them to do that. And so I think maybe a way to look at in the future that might help that would, and then also to give the people that want the better game and the higher quality animals, maybe a way to do that, and something to consider would be in the drawing to either they have to choose whether they put in for a limited entry unit or they choose to put in for a general unit. Right now you can put in for a general unit and a limited entry unit. Maybe that ought to be specified to where if someone wants to go out and just hunt and be out in the wild and partake of the opportunities that's there, they can still have that by submitting for just the general draw. And then the people that have the ambition to shoot a high quality animal, they can put in for the limited entry units, and you know, they probably draw every 5 or 6 years, and that might be a way to appease both sides of the public. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. We've already adopted for this year the rules for the application process, so that will come around again next year, but we can try to keep that in mind. I know it's been looked at before. So any additional comments from the public? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and go to the council. Anyone have something specific they want to comment on to start with? Jim.
First, I want to comment on a comment, which was that according to the Bowman's organization, the state is evenly split, or hunters are evenly split as to opportunity versus increased buck-to-doe ratios. And in the information that I have, the emails and communications I've had with hunters, that's not even close. I think I tabulated about 40 emails, three of which wanted increased buck-to-doe ratios. All the rest of them mentioned family hunts and increased opportunity. Now, the rules allow me to request that something be entered into the official minutes. So I'm requesting that this email, which I received from a young lady, be put into the minutes. I will provide you with a written copy of it. Copy. Hi, my name is Kayla. I'm 14 years old. I just got my hunter safety last year, and my dad bought me a new bow for Christmas, and I am very excited for this year's deer hunt! My dad told me, though, that it may be harder for me to get a tag this year because some changes were made that will make it so there are some bigger bucks. I don't exactly understand the changes, but I am not worried about bigger bucks. I would rather be able to get a tag and hunt with my dad and grandpa. He told me that because I felt so strongly about this, I should write an email to you telling you how I feel. My dad told me that you were talking about changes this year that would mean there are more tags and give me a better chance to get one and hunt with him. That way I understand what my dad told me. I just want to hunt so bad, and I don't care if there are a few more bucks as long as I get a tag. I'm hoping that you don't cut tags this year, and I have been practicing shooting almost every day after school because I am so excited to hunt deer this year. I hope to get to shoot a big buck one day, but that's not as important to me as hunting with my family. My dad says there are special hunts so that people can have a good chance at big bucks, and my dad says I can put in for one of those too, so until I get one of those, I just want to go hunt deer. I don't care if there are lots of big bucks as long as I get to hunt. Thank you for reading my email to you today. Sincerely, Kayla. That's where it's at as far as I'm concerned. This is not about increasing the deer herd, as Anise has told us, and it's not the first time he's told us that. This is about, are we going to get to hunt or not? And I'm not related to this girl, but I wish I were her grandpa so I could go hunting with her. But more than that, I wish that she gets a tag. And if she doesn't get a tag, I hope it's not our fault on this rack. So, having said that, I'll make a motion, and I understand that everybody else still has opportunities to discuss, but my motion is that we move to have a statewide 15 to 17 buck per doe ratio.
Jim, thank you for sharing that email, and in the future, if you'll forward them to me, I can get them out to everyone on the council.
I think everybody got one.
I don't think I've read that one, though. So
easily missed in the deluge of emails.
So I
will do that in the future.
Okay, your motion is for 15 to 17 statewide.
Correct.
Is there a second? Okay. Seeing none, the motion fails for lack of a second. Additional discussion or motions? Paul.
You know, I just want to express my concern as we start taking from one group of hunters and applying the tags to a second group of hunters or two other hunters. So in this case, we're actually dropping the rifle tags, which are, I would suspect, are a lot of the younger hunters, to the tune of 6,100 permits, and then we're jumping the muzzleloader tags and archery tags. So I'm just a little concerned as we start making those shifts during cut years, when it seems to me like it'd be better off to see everyone take a bit of that cut.
Okay. Anyone else? Any motions? Jim?
Well, I just want to say I agree with Paul. The rifle hunt's the bread and butter. And even though I switched to muzzleloaders years ago, I still think that they're the ones that take the hits most of the time, and the archery and muzzleloader guys seem to get some preferential treatment. And so I just want to say I agree with Paul.
Bryce.
I'd just like to agree with, or, you know, thank the division for trying to accommodate and change the system so we don't lose 8,000 or 9,000 deer permits. Like, was proposed if we're back to the 18 to 25, you know, granted we're going to lose a few rifle hunters, but, you know, maybe people will take up archery and muzzleloader, you know, like the little girl you mentioned, so hopefully there'll be more tags for her. You know, at the end of the day, to only lose 500 tags instead of, you know, roughly 10,000, you know, I think they've done a good job to come up with that approach they have, so. And I'd like to make a motion to that we accept it as presented.
I'll second it.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to approve the deer management plan amendment. Anise, does that include the general season deer permit numbers?
It does.
Okay. So if I could just state it as the agenda item, okay. The deer management plan amendment and general season deer permit recommendations for 2012 as presented.
Yes. Discussion.
Is that okay with you, Jim? Okay. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, we'll have a vote. Please raise your hand and say aye.
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 Okay. Opposed?
Okay.
So 8-4, one opposed. Go ahead, Nace.
All right. Thank you again, Mr. Chair. Okay, we'll move on with the rest of the Bucks Bulls Once in a Lifetime. Now I'd like to present the premium limited entry recommendation. In Utah, we have two premium limited entry units. Those are the Henry Mountains and the Ponsagant. On those units, we manage in two different ways, and I'll explain a little bit why we do that. We manage for premium permits. These are permits that are sought after, and we actually harvest very few animals with those permits, given that buck-to-doe ratios tend to rise because of that. So to deal with that, we've done what we call a management buck hunt to actually harvest additional bucks without, you know, harvesting those bigger bucks that make those units premium limited entry. So the way we set permits on these units is the premium tags we manage for 40% to 55% of the harvest being 5 years or older on a three-year average. So the way that works is when people harvest their animal, they're asked to send the teeth in, we age those animals, and as long as we stay between 40 to 55% of the harvest being 5 years or older, we can maintain permits. If it goes above that, we can increase permits. And I've color-coded most of my presentations that show green means we could increase permits, yellow means we could either stay status quo or reduce permits, so just so you know going forward. So from this from this table, you can see that there is a potential to increase permits on the Henry Mountains for both the premium permits and the management buck permits. The Ponsagant, however, is within objective on both, and there is no need to actually increase permits on that. In fact, they recommend to reduce some permits on the management buck, and I'll explain that in a minute. So given the information I just gave you, we are recommending a 10% increase in permits on the Henry Mountains. In the statewide plans, it does state that we cannot increase more than 10% in any 1 year. So we are recommending a 10% increase of four permits, going from 44 last year to 48 this year. The Ponsagant, we're recommending no change because it is within objective. So we had a total of 135 permits last year, and we'll have a total of 135 this year. Now on the management buck permits, I did mention on the Henry Mountains that we could potentially have more management buck permits. The region is concerned of crowding issues on that unit. It's one of those units that's not very big, and they have bison hunts and other things going on. So they recommended leaving the 30 permits. It is above the minimum that they could have on that unit. The minimum is 10, and they want to see how it plays out in another year. If it does not bring the buck-to-doe ratio down, they may try splitting the seasons and having additional permits that way. The Ponsagant has actually dropped buck-to-doe ratio, so they're recommending dropping the permits and maintaining those to see if they can maintain that buck-to-doe ratio below 50. So no additional permits on the Henrys, and then a cut in permits on the Ponsagon. These are the management buck permits. Okay. Moving on to limited entry units. On these units, we manage for 25 to 35 bucks per 100 dose postseason. And again, the color coding there, the green are the units that could increase in permits, and the ones that are not colored are the ones that can stay status quo. Given that the South Slope Diamond Mountain has not recommended, the region has not recommended an increase, there was a motion that was passed by the board a few years ago that that unit would transition to premium limited entry, and they're waiting. They're basically leaving the permits as they are until the buck door ratio arrives there before they transition to premium limited entry. The book lifts, they've also recommended no increase in permits. They've had poor fawn production the last few years, and they anticipate eventually that will catch up to the buck to doe ratio because the population is actually on a slight decline. So they also recommended no increase in permits there. And similarly, the San Juan, I think there may be a small increase of permits on that one, but nothing major. And it's a similar situation where fawn doe ratios are low all the time on that unit. So given that, basically we had 986 permits last year, a slight reduction to 967, and that reduction actually comes from a loss of one unit. The Thousand Lakes unit used to be limited entry and now has gone to general season. So it's really not a decrease in permits on the current units, it's just because we lost a unit. Okay, moving to general season elk and limited entry elk. In our statewide plan for elk, it calls for spike permits to remain at 15,000 as long as hunt success rates stay below 20%. And then in 2011, the success rate was 13%. So given that, we are recommending maintaining the 15,000 permits of spike permits statewide. That's no change from last year. We're also recommending no change in general any bull unit permits with one exception. So we still recommend the 14,300 any bull permits statewide and the 300 youth any bull permits statewide. But we are recommending an increase of 5 permits in the youth any bull permit in the northeastern region. If you recall, in November when we set the season, they actually expanded that unit to encompass more area, and they feel that they could offer a little bit more opportunity for youth because of that expansion. Okay, moving to limited entry elk, not a major change there, basically a slight decrease in permits from 2989 to 2956. Although it looks like not a whole lot of changes, there actually, when you look at the details, there is a little bit of change, and I'll go through that to explain some of that. Basically, on our units where we manage for the highest bull ages in the harvest, again, we manage these units for a 7.5 to 8-year-old bull in the harvest on a 3-year average. All these units were actually brought up to this objective. The objective used to be lower, so we're actually playing catch up, and that's why we keep having to reduce permits on a lot of these units. We were managing for a lower, it was a lower age objective, and now we're cutting permits to get to that. So on those highest objective units, we're recommending a 51 permit cut, and you can see the different units that require a cut there. On the second tier, these are the units where we manage for a 6.5 to 7-year-old objective. Similarly, a lot of these units were brought up to this objective, so we're behind the eight ball on some of them, and we are recommending cuts to get to that objective. So on those, you can see 3 units could use a cut, and you know, with the exception of the booklets is just right there in the middle. So, but all of them are recommending cuts of about 22 permits overall. Okay, these units are the units we manage for a 5.5 to 6-year-old bull in the harvest. These are probably the units that carry most of the elk in the state. They're large units with lots of elk in them. On these units, we're recommending a total of 20 permit increase. But as you can see, there's a few units that are right in the objective, but a few that could have an increase. So some have reduced, some have increased, but the total is about 20 permit increase. OK, Okay, and these units, the 4.5 to 5-year-old age class, we manage those for a 3-year average of that. As you can see, most of those are above objective. And then given they're fairly small units, there's only a 35 permit increase. So even though the overall permit numbers reduced slightly, there, you can see kind of how some increased, some decreased, and overall it came out almost a wash. Okay, moving to pronghorn permits. Again, not a substantial increase from last year. We had a total 658 buck pronghorn permits last year. This year we're recommending 665. There are a few more permits on the plateau unit. That unit's has come back up to objective, and they're able to offer a few more permits there. Okay, moving to once-in-a-lifetime permits. Whoops, went ahead too far. Okay, we'll start with moose. Moose, we're recommending a decrease in permits from 93 last year to 76 this year. Our moose populations, at least in the northern extreme part of the state, are stagnant to slightly declining, and we've seen that reflected in the ages of the bulls, so we're recommending a reduction in permits to try to get those ages back up where they should be in our management plans. For bison, we're recommending an increase in permits from 20 to 60. In the past, we've only had one unit, the Henry Mountains unit. This year will be the first year we'll be hunting the Booklifts unit, where we'll have 4 permits. We'll only be hunting a portion of that unit and basically taking advantage of some animals that are moving off the Ute tribe and harvesting those. The animals we transplanted there still don't have enough age to them to start harvesting them. We probably will start seeing some permits on that, on the entire unit, for the next couple of years. But given that, 4 permits is still a pretty good increase, and the rationale for that is on the Henry Mountains, we're starting to get to that objective. We were in a growth mode, so we had few permits. Now that we're getting to objective, it requires more permits to maintain that objective. And that's why the increase in permits. We've also had good calf recruitment, calf production and recruitment in that herd as well. Desert bighorn sheep, we're recommending a slight decline in permits from 41 to 44. Most of these declines are in units where we're having probably some disease issues, but declining sheep populations. There's actually one unit where we've increased permits quite a bit, and that's the Zion unit, where we've gone from 6 to 9 permits this year. Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, 4 permit increase, most of those on the rattlesnake unit. That unit along the Green River has very good production, seems to be doing very well. Rocky Mountain goat, that's another success story, I guess you could say. We're increasing permits again, and the majority of those are both on the Willard and on the Tushers. Both of those populations are increasing, and we would like to get them within objective. On both of those, the Forest Service quite concerned with plant communities up in that alpine area, and we want to make sure we stay within what we've agreed with them on populations. Okay, moving to some recommended rule changes. I have 3 recommended rule changes, starting with this one. This one deals with muzzleloaders. Basically, it deals with the kind of powder you can use in a muzzleloader. In the past, we did not allow black powder to be used that contained nitrocellulose. There is a product on the market now called Blackhorn 209 that actually contains nitrocellulose. And our law enforcement folks looked at the research, and it shows about an average 5% increase in velocity of a projectile. They didn't feel that was enough of a change to prohibit it, so they are allowing the use of Blackhorn 209, which contains nitrocellulose. You still cannot use smokeless powder. It still has to be a black powder. It is also a cleaner burning black powder, which makes cleaning a muzzleloader easier. The second rule amendment that we're recommending is the use of a blood trailing dog controlled by a leash during lawful hunting hours and within 72 hours of shooting big game, basically to track wounded animals and aid in recovery. This provides a means for hunters to increase their chance to locate and harvest wounded big game, and will lead to an increase in decreased wounding loss. Sorry about that. This is allowed in Idaho, and basically the language we've used mirrors kind of what they have in their rules. The third recommended rule change deals with antlerless elk hunting. This is something we ran into last year, which I didn't realize was the case. Basically, it allows hunters that have two antlerless elk permits on the same unit but for different seasons to harvest two in either season. I had a hunter call me last year that had drawn a tag on a unit, and then there were some available tags over the counter that he picked up. You can have two antlerless elk permits. But they were for two different seasons, and he asked me, well, if I see two cows together, can I shoot them? And I was like, well, I would think so. You know, I didn't see a reason why that wouldn't be the case. But when I talked to our law enforcement folks, they said, no, in the rule it says they cannot. So we asked them if it would be amenable to them to change the rule, and they said it would work. So this deals with that very rare instance when someone has two antlerless elk permits on the same unit but for different seasons. And with that, I thank you, and I'll be glad to take any questions.
Any questions from the public on the presentation?
Sorry, real quick. My name is Dallin Swainstein from North Logan. Just real quick on the antlerless permit. So you have two different seasons. So if you weren't successful on your cow tag that first season, that later season you could still use both tags, is that correct?
Correct.
So then you'd basically have a tag for both, okay.
Or you could harvest them both early if you wanted to.
Okay, I understood the early part, but I was wondering if it still applied during the later season. Okay, perfect.
Smack me in the mouth. I just noticed on the moose, the numbers dropped for the residents but increased for the non-residents.
Yeah. I got that question at almost every rack. So the reason for that is similar to the question that was asked earlier. So basically, you can reduce total permits, but the number of non-residents stay the same, because even if you're at 10 permits on one unit, you can issue 9 and 1. And if you drop to 5, you can still issue 4 and 1. So the non-residents doesn't drop as quickly as the resident does, just because we round from.
But it actually increased.
Yeah, it might have been some units that you know, changed. Maybe they had only 4 last year, and now they have 5, but some units have decreased.
But on those units where then the resident numbers increased as well.
Yeah. Okay. There has been some inconsistencies in the past where they haven't been. So I don't know if you know, but we often have to set our, whether we're going to have a non-resident or not, prior to when we set our permits. So if they thought they were going to have a non-resident, it was already in the drawing, so we had to commit to that one. Yeah. Okay. So there are some of those issues as well.
Thank you.
Yep.
Robert, you need a name on that last comment.
Sorry, it's Mike Schultz.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks. Any additional questions from the public on the last presentation? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go to the rack. Anise, so you haven't been applying the rounding rule very consistently in the past.
That's
on
correct.
Moose.
Yeah, on but anything. This year we've made a great effort to make sure everybody's doing it right.
Okay. So where you committed in advance to have a tag for non-residents, even though maybe it didn't fit the criteria, are you going to balance that out in future years?
Well, the way it works is once you've committed to it, no matter how many permits you end up having, you have to have one non-resident. So there's not a whole lot else you can do in future years. The total number of moose killed are not above
what you allow.
Yeah, it's just the proportion of resident and non-resident.
But say we only had 4 permits, but we committed to have one for a non-resident.
Right.
So it's 4 and 1, total's 5.
It'd be 3 and 1.
Okay, or 3 and 1. So if you know now that it's going to be that, it's probably going to be that again next year, you could take that one out of the application process next year.
Yeah, and we do that if we knew it. I mean, they have to set whether there's going to be a resident or non-resident in November. and we're setting permits now. So once they got the data, they realized that, you know, age has dropped quite a bit. So it's kind of one of those anomalies where it happens rarely, where you get something that unexpected. But
But if you see that this year, you could take this that non-resident tag out for next year in advance.
Yeah, that's exactly the way we'll do it.
Okay. You said that there was an increase on the rattlesnake rocky tags.
Yeah.
But in the handout, it just shows six straight across.
Is it?
It was the Range Creek.
The Range Creek, maybe.
Oh, Range Creek. Okay.
Yeah. Those units are right across the river from each other. I always get them confused.
Okay. Any additional questions from the council?
There probably should have been one additional on the rattlesnake, but that region is really stingy with their permits.
All right. John Cavett.
I was wondering, could you, I might have missed it, but what is going on with the declines in the moose population?
So, yeah, we're not exactly sure. To be honest, we are initiating a research project to look at some of that. It could be a lot of different things. I mean, we have some ideas, but we can't pinpoint one of them. So we've got parasites called Iliophora that they all, almost 70% of the moose have. We've got selenium deficiency going on. We've got, you know, all kinds of different things that could be affecting. Selenium deficiency causes what's called white muscle syndrome, where, you know, they lose muscle mass, and so. And it could be that we may have carried moose over their carrying capacity for too long, and now they're crashing. There's lots of different scenarios. We want to investigate all of those and see what it is. So we're initiating a study to look at that, look at vital rates and see survival rates and things like that.
Thanks.
Bryce.
On the desert sheep,
mm-hmm.
Is it the Dirty Devil that's having the problems, or is there other units?
It's the Centerfell, both north and south, and the Dirty Devil as well. I think they reduced one or two permits on the Dirty Devil, but I'm not sure. Two, yeah. So,
is that kind of, alarming problem?
Oh, it certainly is. I mean, we are investigating, especially on the north Centerfell. We've got a new research project there to look at why, because that population has been on a long-term decline. Oftentimes, when you see those kind of things, it could be just because of they live in arid environments and their reproduction just didn't reach potential, or there could be some disease issues, and you have to investigate it further to find out. Yeah, we're always alarmed when sheep populations decline because they're so susceptible to disease.
Additional questions from the council? Anise, if we have any moose trapping that's required during the winter, are we going to transport those within the state? Are we going to continue to trade them out? Or
likely, no. We have no plans to take moose outside of the state. The southeast region did just approve a new moose unit on the 9 Mile, so they're looking for moose. We haven't had really any very few problem moose the last couple of years because the population's at a low level. So I don't anticipate we're going to be moving a lot of moose, but if we do, it would be in-state.
Okay. John Kevin.
I'm sorry, I have one more question. So what is the reason that we have to establish non-resident permits before residents?
Because the drawing happens before we set permits. So there has to be a way for them to know whether they can put in for a hunt or not.
Any additional questions from the council?
And usually it requires an educated guess on the biologist part, and sometimes they're right on, and occasionally they're off. So, and moose is one where we didn't expect to see that much of a decline in 1 year.
Questions? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go to the public for comments. I don't have any comment cards on this item number 6. Is there anyone? Byron.
Byron Bateman, I'm representing Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. I think the division has done a really great job this year so far with the recommendations they come up with. I know especially on the premium limited entry bucks, once in a lifetime. The moose, we have a problem, and we're addressing it, like Anise said, with the study and stuff like that. A bunch of the conservation groups have met a week ago today to put our money back on the ground, so to say, and we all chipped in a large amount of money for moose research to see what's actually happening with the moose. So hopefully we can turn that loss around and you know, bring that moose population back up. We primarily have a concern with our limited entry elk tags on some of our premium units. We've already gone below the age objective on some of these units. One specific is the Pavant, which is one of our premium units in the state, and everybody knows that. Our concern is that on some of these other recommendations that we have right now, for the South Cache, the Book Cliffs, the Mount Dutton, the Wasatch, and the Manti, especially the Book Cliffs, it's currently below the age class. It's at the age class recommendation is the objective is 6.75. It's currently at 6.4. With the increased reductions that are proposed right now, that's going to drop that, you know, close to 20 or 30% below that age class objective. So on the Book Cliffs, and this is only the road part of the Book Cliffs, we'd like to see the tags reduced from the current number down to 120. The Mount Dutton, the age class, is supposed to be at 5.75. We're currently at 5.0. We'd like to see the number of tags reduced on that to 110. The Wasatch, we'd just like to see that left the same as last year, at the 603 tags. And then the Manti, we'd like to see that go back to 360. That's what it was in 2009. Once you go below these age class objectives, it takes a greater cut to bring it back up than it does to reduce it. You're looking at a 40% reduction. If we're trying to bring the Pavant back up to where it should be right now, you're going to have to see a reduction of 40% of the tags on that unit to bring it back up to what that age class is. I don't know if you guys have this colored breakout of the years and the age classes for the elk like we have. But what I'm talking about is the Wildlife Board objective for the age classes that we just need to look at on those specific units. I'd like to see the South Cache stay the same as 2011 at 111 tags. So just as a recap, so you got that right, Robert, it's South Cache would stay the same as 2011 at 111. The Book Cliffs, the road part, which Bitter Creek, would go back to 120. Mount Dutton would be 110. The Wasatch would be 603. And the Manti would be 360.
Is the Manti higher than 360 or lower than 360 right now?
It's significantly higher than that right now.
So you want a reduction to 360?
Correct. The Manti right now, they're asking for 482 tags on that. Some of these guys have been waiting, you know, as high as, what, 19 years now for maximum points to draw these tags. And, you know, the quality of, you know, big bulls out there has really decreased over the years. So we just want to back off on these. We don't want to tip them over completely. Like I said, we've already done that on the Pavant. We dropped down below the age objective on that one. And like I said, the Book Cliffs is 3.3 below. The Dutton is 0.75 below age class objective. Getting close. I just appreciate the opportunity again. I know you guys put a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of work into this, and you've had a lot of stuff to look at. So just consider these five units, reducing these tags. Thank you.
Thank you, Byron. Excuse me for a second. Jerry Hill. We're not setting conservation permit numbers. We don't actually do that. So, could you tell him how the permit conservation permit numbers are arrived at, Anise?
Sure. So there's a rule that governs the permits that go into the conservation permit program. That rule goes out, and the number of permits that go into the actually goes in front of you guys, and you set them. I think you just did it I don't know, a couple of racks ago. But basically, yeah, it's set by rule. So it's either 5% or a total of 8 on any given unit on most species. So you can, you shouldn't be able to go above 5% or 8 total permits on any. Now, those are set for 3 years, so you could actually have 5% and then within those 3 years go above it. That rule is going to be up for review this coming RAC, this, the one that's coming up, and there will be some changes made to deal with some of those inconsistencies. So if we, like moose is the one that comes up a lot, we had to make a drastic cut, yet the number of permits we have for a three-year is higher, it will end up being higher than 5% if we continue to cut permits. So that's how it's set. Do I need to elaborate?
And in the past, the conservation permit numbers were moved to the wildlife board for, we don't even really see those numbers.
Okay. Yeah, so they just go straight to the board.
Yeah. Could you respond to some of the age classifications from Byron's comments?
Certainly. All the numbers he quoted were 1 year worth of data, and we go on 3 year averages. Now we do consider trends. So if we see a 1 year drop in 1 year, obviously we realize that that's probably getting to close to where we need to cut permits. Our biologists are aware of all the things that he mentioned, that it is harder to actually come back up than come low. But all of our recommendations are based on that three-year average and then how much we need to reduce or increase permits to get to objective. So I think our recommendations are sound. Whenever you raise permits, there is always a slight chance you're going to over-harvest, but that hasn't been the trends thus far. I mean, we've been increasing permits pretty regularly. The only time we've fallen behind is when the objective was actually raised and we were managing for a lower objective, and now we have to try to catch up. But none of these units apply to that scenario. So that's...
Okay.
That's
Thank
makes
you.
Sense.
I don't have any additional blue cards for comments from the public on this agenda item. Is there anyone who'd want to comment? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Comments and or motions?
I have a question.
Anne. Sure, you could ask Denise.
Getting your exercise. With the age classes, what is the margin of error that you have around each one of those numbers, 6.5 as 6.7, 6.1?
Sure. It's fairly low. We don't really have a margin of error. We get about 80%, 75 to 80% return, so the margin of error is really small. If you know stats, when you get up above anything above 40% is phenomenal. So we feel very comfortable with the data being accurate. I mean, it could be, like 0.1 year above and 0.1 year below.
Right. Well, that's what I was thinking is like the difference between 6.1 and 6.2 could just be wash.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it could be. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, that's why we go with a three-year average.
Correct.
It levels out a lot of the data because you could get 1 year where an anomaly and you got that 0.1 or 0.2 difference from the year before. And we've seen this in the past. And on the Manti, for example, we saw it where it dropped almost half a year in one year, and then the region backed off, and then the next year it went back up. So it's hard to say. I mean...
Have you ever done anything like a five-year average, or do you have that much data?
Yeah, we have that much data. It actually makes it even, because we've been higher, so we would actually be recommending more if we had a five-year permit,
okay.
Five-year average. So that's why we go with a three-year average, because it's closer to reality. The further back you go, the more permits you could actually issue.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Comments? comments from the council?
I guess I don't disagree that we're getting close on a lot of these units. We just haven't got there.
Paul?
I just have a general comment. You know, if Sportsman's for Fish and Wildlife, Byron, if you guys are getting numbers that we're not seeing, you know, when you present some of your material, it makes it really hard for us to track.
You have all the numbers he was talking about. It's this paper right here.
This one right here? Okay. And I wasn't tracking it well through that discussion. So.
Yeah. He was referring to the last year, so the 2011.
Okay.
And then we go by that.
The three-year average. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Comments and or motions from the council? Craig.
Yeah, I have a comment. I think if we're going to err, I think we should err on the side that doesn't reduce the age. I just think that there's people out there who are wanting a chance at a trophy elk, and I just don't want us to start a trend the other way. I think if we're going to err, we should err the other way.
Jim.
I move we accept the recommendations of the division regarding this entire discussion.
As presented?
As presented.
I second.
Okay. So we have a motion from Jim Gaskell and a second from John Wall to recommend approval of the Bucks and Bulls and once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations and rule amendments for 2012. Discussion on the motion? Okay, have a vote. All in favor? 9-4. Opposed? None. We're going to have a 15-minute break. Is that okay, Anise?
Great.
Okay. Did we make it through that sound mic check there? All right. Okay, Anise. Go ahead with Antlers' permit recommendations for 2012.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you all for bearing with me. Next, I'll be presenting the antlerless recommendations for 2012. Start with deer. I've already shown this graph in the other presentation, so I won't elaborate on it. It's basically showing production throughout, which usually tracks what populations do. So this graph actually shows what our population estimates for mule deer are. As you can see, the last three-year trend is a slight decline, and our target is around 350, and we're right around 286. Given that, we're recommending only 290 permits for doe deer this year. 140 of those are dealing with either depredation or nuisance issues in valley areas. The 150 of those are on one unit, the Panguitch Lake unit, basically on the west side of the Panguitch Lake unit along the Parowan Front. There's a small piece of winter range where that winters a lot of deer, and we're starting to see some habitat damage where overhedging of shrubs that could potentially kill those shrubs is happening. And we're recommending 150 permits split into two hunts on that unit to reduce the deer population there to try to keep that brush healthy. So that's our recommendation for antlerless deer, 290 permits, 150 of those on the Panguitch Lake unit, and the other 140 are distributed in different areas where we have depredation or nuisance issues. To move with elk, a little bit different story with elk. We are over objective. Our objective is right around 69,000. We're currently around 75,000 elk in the state. Given that, we're increasing our elk permits We had 12,174 permits last year. We're recommending 13,108 permits last year. This is both to reduce populations that are over objective and to maintain populations that may be at objective. Even if you're at objective with elk populations, you have to issue enough permits to basically harvest the surplus, so any of the fawns that are born that will survive for the following year. So our recommendation for elk is 13,108 permits, and you have the specifics there in your handout. Elk control permits, these are permits that hunters can purchase if they have a buck, bull, or once-in-a-lifetime permits on these specific units. Basically, there are three units in the state where we want a zero elk objective. It's not really good elk habitat. These are the Henry Mountains, the North San Rafael, and the San Juan Any Bull unit. On these units, because we want zero elk, we encourage hunters that hunt those units for deer or elk to actually, you know, buy one of these over-the-counter tags and harvest the cow if they see one. Then we also have five units in the state where, because of either private land issues or tribal land issues, we're unable to harvest enough cows to get the population under control. And we've had three units in the past, and this year we added two more units, the ones in yellow. So those five units there, the Nine Mile Range Creek, the East Canyon, Chalk Creek, Morgan South Ridge, and South Slope Yellowstone, are units where we're having we have an overpopulation of elk, and we can't get enough of a harvest. Given that, we're issuing what we call control permits. So basically, if you have a deer tag, an elk tag, an antlered, like a buck tag or a bull tag, on these units, you can purchase these over-the-counter permits for a reduced rate and harvest a cow if you see one on these units during your hunt. Moving to doe pronghorn permits, we're recommending a slight increase from 467 last year to 527 this year. A couple of units have the majority of these. Basically, the Cache North Ridge has quite a few tags, and the Plateau unit has just reached objective, as I mentioned, and they've issued 100 permits just to make sure they're not behind the eight ball when that population starts to increase, which it usually does. Moose permits, as I mentioned, we've got some issues with our moose in the state. We're not sure exactly what's going on. Given that, we want to make sure we don't over-harvest the antlerless portion of the population. So we're recommending zero antlerless moose permits for 2012. And that's my antlerless presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Anise. Do we have any questions from the public on Anise's presentation? Seeing none, do we have any questions from the council on Anise's presentation? Jim.
Anise, do you have any estimate of how many antlerless animals are killed by landowners based on depredation tags?
Yeah, we do have estimates. I don't know if I have them here. They're a small proportion, depending on the unit, but they can be substantial. Did you have one specific unit in mind?
No, I just wondered, what is that, greater or less than the number that are...
It's much less.
Much less than what you're recommending,
correct,
for the hunters.
Again, it's not included in this, so it's above and beyond that. And,
right,
and those we deal with one-on-one basis. So some years it could be higher if we have a bad winter and they end up in fields. Some years it's a lot lower, so it just depends. But usually it never exceeds the number of permits that go over the.
But certainly could be in lots of areas where there aren't any other animals.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in some areas, in some units on some years, you could exceed what we put in the drawing just because of circumstances.
Paul.
Anise, I'm just curious. So with some of the antlerless elk in these, I think there are five units that you showed at the bottom of the page, mm-hmm, that where if someone already has a permit, then they could go ahead and purchase a cow permit. And I'm wondering why we wouldn't open the cow permits up to anyone to purchase outright versus already giving someone who has that opportunity to hunt.
Yeah, so the reason for that is you would end up with so many permits out there that you may over-harvest just because you don't want an unlimited number of cow tags out there. We already know how many people are hunting these areas by giving them a potential tag. We know how many we have a potential to harvest. Where if we just open it up, we don't know what the potential for harvest is. Thus, they may over-harvest one year, and then we would be, you know, left scratching our heads.
Okay, so if they have a bow tag that they can or a bow permit, mm-hmm. and they're able to pick up a cow permit, do they shoot one or the other?
No, they can harvest both because they have two valid permits, yeah.
So I guess I don't understand then, and maybe if you still, you know, you've got the number, you could regulate the number of permits that you could sell for antlerless.
Yeah.
And still keep it under control. I mean, I don't see the point.
Rationale for it. These units, the reason we can't harvest enough is because of private land issues. We could issue all the permits in the world, and if they can't gain access, they're not going to harvest. So what we do is we offer these over the counter. These are folks that have already got a place to hunt because they have a buck or a bull tag. And then if they see a cow, they can harvest it. They're already, I guess, in the system. So we have issued lots of permits on these units in the past. Neither they've gone undersold or people that have bought them were unable to find a place to hunt.
Okay, so they're in like CWM?
Well, they're in areas where they're predominantly private land, or tribal lands prohibit the harvest. That's why they're so unique. There are five units in the state that are, you know, they're predominantly private lands. And we're looking at other things as well to try to deal with that. We do want, on one unit, we may issue enough permits that we would ensure that there will be over-the-counter tags for those folks that may be able to get access on private land. So, or the private landowner may want to buy it or whatever. So we're looking at different options. This is just one step to get us closer.
Yeah, I just know like the South Yellowstone is on our, part of it's on our mm-hmm. forest, and there's quite a bit of public land,
there
at
is.
Least on that portion of it. So.
Yeah, but as you know, a lot of it's wilderness, and then the elk seek refuge on the tribe a lot of the times when you start hunting them.
Okay, thank you.
Anise, on the San Juan, you have it as the Any Bull unit.
Right.
In the past, that's overlapped onto the Spike unit on the north.
So this is the portion that doesn't overlap with it.
Okay.
So it's south of Highway.
Have you changed the boundary then?
Yeah, there isn't any bull unit designation. The Spike unit is only on the west side, west side of the highway. On the east side and south of, I forget the
491.
491 is the any bull unit.
So, in the past, the control permits were for the east of 491, and it was on the any bull unit and the Spike bull unit. And that area east of 491.
Yeah, I don't believe that. That wasn't intended if people were hunting it that way.
Well, it was just to control the cows on that farming land.
Bean fields.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if you changed the unit boundary or not, because
I do believe it. The boundary is correct because it's that any bull portion only. So that any bull portion is in the guidebook as that part south of 491.
Okay, because in the past it was bull.
Yeah.
So you've changed it. You want to check that because you do have a big problem in both sections.
Sure.
That's why it was designed that way originally.
But we only want zero elk on the one portion.
Except for the farmers want zero on the north too.
Right.
So
except they have a CWMU there as well. So
two, three.
So if you have zero elk, they're out of business.
Uh-huh. But just check your boundary.
I will.
Because this is where we're adopting the rules too, right?
Right.
Basically, we're adopting the guidebook for the hunting part.
The boundaries have already gone through, and I believe it's correct, but I'll double check it to make sure.
All right, thank you. Any additional questions from the council for Anise? Seeing none, we'll go to the public for comment. Byron? Jerry, I've got one for you.
Thank you. My name is Byron Bateman. I represent SFW again. There's only two units that we have a real issue with. That's the Manti and the Wasatch. We would recommend that we keep the Manti and the Wasatch the same as they were last year. The Wasatch unit specifically, you're asking for 4,000 cow tags, and the population objective on the Wasatch, those three Wasatch units combined, is only 5,000. That's 80% of the total population you're asking for tags for on the Wasatch. If you look at the Manti, it's 12,000 elk, and they're asking for 1,900. Why would you ask for more on a smaller unit with a smaller population objective? It just doesn't make sense to us. And then a lot of the people we talk to that hunt and live next to those units and stuff like that, they're telling us that the populations are down below objective. And then with the past winter we had, which is really open, or you plan to do a bunch of flying and stuff like that, and you weren't able to fly and do some counts on some of those units and stuff like that. So again, I just like to ask you to err on the side of caution. Let's keep those tags at the same level as they were in 2011. It's on the antlerless page for the cow elk in your book there. But if you add them up and look at the numbers, I mean, it's just, why would you put out 80% of a 5,000 elk population objective? 4,000 tags seems awful high on the Wasatch. And then to go to 1,900 tags on the Manti is a large number, too. So if you just look at that, let's just keep it like that for one more year. Hopefully next year we'll get a bunch of snow, and you can go out and fly and count those and see where we're really at population-wise. But let's just be careful and don't really issue a whole bunch of tags to kill a whole lot of elk on those two units.
Byron, what I'm seeing on Wasatch, it looks like the 2011 population estimate is about, what is that? About 7,600.
Yeah, but I'm looking at the actual objective for the unit itself.
Yeah, so the population is actually over the objective, it looks like, on those three units.
But still, that's an awfully large number. Like I say, and our people don't, think that those numbers are right, especially on the Wasatch unit. It's so much smaller than the Manti to have that many elk right there in a smaller area. That last year we had a lot of snow, a lot of elk got pushed into different areas we were not pushed before and counted and, come off of different units and stuff like that, so.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry?
Jerry Hill with the United Wildlife Cooperative. We just ask that you pass the recommendation as presented. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. That's all the comment cards I have for this agenda item. Is there anyone else from the public who'd like to comment? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Anise, could you respond to the number of elk on the Wasatch and the Manti for the council?
You bet. So that unit was flown not this year, but that last winter, and it was over objective by over 2,000. So it was like almost 50% over objective. So they issued permits this last year to try to kill enough to start bringing it down. With such a light winter, success rates on those hunts were really low. So that population still sits over objective. And basically, my quick calculations on my phone back here says we need to kill about 2,800 elk to even start bringing it near objective. And then issuing 4,000 permits at roughly, I don't know, usually success rate ranges between 40 and 60, so let's say 50% success, you're not going to touch that number. So that's how we set our antlerless permits, is basically to try to get us to objective based on a certain success rate. I agree, it looks like a lot of permits, but obviously not every hunter that gets a permit is going to harvest. Like I mentioned, our success rates on antlerless elk are 40 to 60%. And most this last year, there were actually 32% success on that unit. So it does require that many permits to get this unit to objective. Regardless of what, you know, people observing may think, that unit was flown and counted, and, you know, with sightability, it was way over objective on both the Wasatch side and the other side. So that's the rationale for the permits on the Wasatch. The Manti bumped up their objective is because they're finally above objective, and it always takes more permits to bring populations back than it is to maintain. And that's a population of 12,000, so you have roughly, production is probably more than 2,000, and they're issuing roughly 2,000 permits. So they won't even keep up with production with the number they're recommending, but they wanted to start on a conservative side so not to overshoot. So both the Manti is certainly a conservative estimate number of permits. I don't think they'll get near to controlling that population with those number of permits. The Wasatch is right on. That's the permits they need to control that population. So, I mean, data you have that's based on actual harvest data, actual numbers. We know the number of calves that are going to be born. Elk don't vary a lot from year to year in survival. That's the number we feel will get us to objective. And by law, we are mandated to recommend permits that get us to objective, especially on deer and elk. So doing otherwise, you know, we would not be doing anything for the resource if we didn't.
So flying and counting, it was a bad year to count?
This year we didn't fly. It was flown last year, and it was an excellent year to count last year. Yeah, they got a really good count.
And then how often do you fly a unit?
We usually fly every unit. We try to fly every 3 years. And then we model forward until we fly again.
All right, thank you.
So they've modeled the population, given the usual birth rates and survival rates and all of that. I mean, elk are very, very predictable. You can, you know, set your clock by them. Okay.
Additional comments or questions from the council? Bryce.
My only concern is bumping the permits that much. I remember, probably been 6-7 years ago, we have some property in Idaho just north, and they obviously were over objective, issued a large number of permits, got record snowfall, and just had an absolute slaughter. I mean, people were shooting twos and threes, where you're trying to jam that many people into a season that if you do get a lot of snow, that it could be almost, you know, a little bit too much.
Yeah, there's a potential for high harvest, but even on years where we've had exceptional conditions, success rates never risen above 60.
60 is the max?
60% success.
What was it last year?
And most of the permits are not late season. There, a lot of them are in the general October time frame, if you look at the dates. So a chance of that kind of snowstorm happening that time of year is fairly low, early October.
So most of those increases are earlier season then?
Yeah, if you look at the, a lot of the permits are in that early season, and that's why they've increased them so much, because success rate actually in that October time frame is actually lower than that even. It's usually in the 30% range. So, I mean, we're charged with maintaining these populations at levels that both hunters and those that want them kept at objective, you know. So we're looking at a lot more data than the casual observer that goes out and says, oh, I don't see as many elk, therefore we should have fewer permits.
Comments on our and or motions from the council? Jim?
Sounds like pretty good explanations to me. I move that we accept the recommendations for antlerless as presented.
I'll second.
We have a motion from Jim Gaskell and a second from Ann Neville to recommend approval of the antlerless permit recommendations for 2012. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor? 8-4, or, oh, Paul, are you in favor?
4.
you're in favor?
I am.
Okay, so 9 in favor, opposed, 0. Randy?
Okay, I will be presenting the CWMU antlerless recommendations tonight. We talk about vouchers and permit numbers in here, and I'm going to try not to confuse them as I go on, so I'll explain to you really quick. CWMUs get vouchers that they can then issue to people. The people would bring the vouchers in to our office and redeem them for a permit. So as we go through here and talk about it, it'll be like private CWMU vouchers, and then the permits are the permits that go out through the public draw. So it would be the public permits as we go through. And I'll try to keep that straight as we go through this. Right now, as a review, we've got 14 CWMUs that are currently under 3-year CORs, and they have been approved for 50 private CWMU vouchers and 197 of the public permits. We have 48 CWMUs that are going to require Wildlife Board actions for antlerless permits in the tune of 338 private CWMU vouchers and 1,061 public permits. So that's a total of 62 CWMUs requesting antlerless permits this year, and we're recommending those two. There's no disputes between us and the CWMUs, for a total of 388 of the CWMU private vouchers and 1,258 of the public permits, for a total of 1,646 vouchers and permits. We have two CWMUs that got into a 3-year contract with antlerless moose permits. We're recommending removing those antlerless moose permits, and you've heard from Anise already why we are doing that, and the two are Stillman Creek Ranches and Grass Valley Clark Canyon CWMUs. We're recommending 0 antlerless moose permits there. This table here is kind of to help you understand allocation of the permits. On the left side up there, you're looking at the buck to bull options that CWMUs have. For deer and elk, there's 4 options. And on the right side of there is the antlerless permit options. And depending on which allocation option they use for the buck, it dictates what they will get for the antlerless. And if you look at the top line there, if it's 90% private, that would be the vouchers, then 10% of those permits go to the public in the public draw. And if the CWMU chooses that, then in the antlerless option, 100% of the antlerless permits go to the public in the public draw. In pronghorn, it's just a 60-40. They don't have a choice. So for the buck, it's 60-40, 60 private, 40 public. And for the antlerless, it's just reversed. 40 goes to the private, and 60% of the antlerless go to the public. Down the center, you're looking at the number of CWMUs this year and which as a particular option, like 32 CWMUs chose the 90-10 split for bulls and then the 0-100% for the antlerless. In 2011, just an overview there, we had a total of 280 CWMU private vouchers and a total of 1,286 public permits, for a total of 1,566 permits. This year in 2012, we're recommending 388 antlerless private CWMU vouchers and 1,258 permits that will go out into the public. That's an increase of about 80, and most of the increase comes in the elk there. And with that, we'll take questions.
Any questions from the public on the presentation?
Oh, if I could, one more thing. In your guys' handout, there was one mistake on the CWMU. It's a typo. It's Deseret, and it's with antlerless elk on Deseret. I think it's on page 3. It shows that for elk, Deseret chose a 90-10 split. For bulls, they actually chose an 85-15 split. And then for the public permits, it's 200 that you see pounds there. It's 200 public permits, 60 CWMU private vouchers. And that's the only problem, so that's a typo in there.
Thank you, Randy. Any questions on Randy's proposal or Randy's presentation? Seeing none. Questions from the council? Craig.
Okay, on the vouchers that are issued, are they all used? Are people using those vouchers and getting permits, all of them?
Do they redeem all their vouchers? For antlerless, pretty well. For their buck and bulls, not all the time. But it's up to them if they want to redeem the vouchers or not.
So they can hold them if they don't want to redeem them.
Yeah, but they are required under the contract and COR to achieve certain harvest levels. So it's to their benefit to achieve those harvest levels.
Bryce.
So, I mean, we just got through hearing the elk objectives are over objective in most places, but according to this number, it's gone down.
The elk, total elk would be, and I don't have...
Public permits.
Okay, and the reason the public permit went down is we've seen some shifts in CWMUs going from the 90-10 split down to the 85-15 or some of the other splits, where that shifts some of the permits over to the CWMU. Does that make sense?
But these are total.
So you're going to say that there's going to be more a shift in bull and buck deer?
No, we're talking antlerless.
I know, but you said they shifted from the 90-10 to 85-15, so we're going to see the return.
That's right. They would give up buck and bull permits.
We'll go up.
For the public.
For the
go
public.
Down
we'll go
down for
up.
The private.
Yeah.
And then in turn, you'll see the public antlerless go down slightly and the CWMU go up a little.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to the public for comment. John Pratt.
Thanks for the opportunity. I'm not sure, I may be at the wrong meeting that you may not address what needs to get addressed, but I would strongly look, are you, Randy, approving new renewals on your CWMUs?
Yeah, so if you, it's a total of...
No, not the permits, but you have 48 that need new three-year CORs.
They are now in new three-year CORs that they came in last September. The buck and bulls have been approved through that process in September.
Okay.
Now what we're doing is bringing the antlerless permits that are in those forward.
Okay, I would question the acceptance or the renewal of specifically three CWMUs in Box Elder County. If you look at your sheet, and it was on the website, but not on, it was not in the packets in the back. There are, across the state, almost every CWMU is either 0 or less than 10% public ground. One old woman in the southern region has 16%, and you have three in this region that have 40 plus, with one being 67% public ground. That's a red flag to me. I don't ask you to change it. I ask you to look at it. There are specific reasons why public ground can be put into a CWMU. Three specifics in the rule. Examine at least one of those, the 67% CWMU, and look at it. Does it match and have the right criteria to become a CWMU with two-thirds of it being public ground? I have a problem having to ask a landowner to hunt public ground or being restricted from hunting public ground by somebody other than the Wildlife Board. And I say, if you've already renewed those CWMUs, then this is a moot point. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Rand, can you respond in the exchange?
As far as the specific CWMU?
Well, I just know that we do have some exchange for including those public lands.
Yes. In order to put them in, they have to, right off the top, lose permits. So if it's a 67% public land, right off the top, 60% of the total permits go to the public. Then you take the leftover and you do the 90-10 split on it. So then from the leftover, the public gets 10% of that. In addition, some CWMUs have other land that's private that they just open up to hunting. And so there can be an exchange. We're going to take this block, but we'll open this up over here for hunting. The biologists look at it to make sure it's an equitable thing. Are they giving up real habitat or hunting opportunity? Is it equal? And so there's several things that go into looking at and issuing those CORs or recommending that the CORs are issued.
Do you identify exchanged lands then on your web page?
They are identified. They've moved, and Justin's shaking his head, so he may know where they are located. But they used to be located with walk-in access. So you would get into walk-in access properties, and in there it would show you the exchange lands for CWMUs. But we've redone servers right down and redone that, and I'm not sure where that is now. But it is available on the web.
All right. Any additional public comments on the agenda item? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. I jumped the gun a little bit. Comments and or motions from the council? Paul.
Just a comment, and then I'll make a motion. In looking at those three CWMUs, and thanks for pointing that out, but all of those permits are public permits. There aren't any private permits, which is interesting. Well, then,
in the antler list,
you're right, for the chart that we have, but not the antlered. You're right. So I'd move at this point that we accept the motion as presented.
Can I?
You want to comment?
I just need to, is the right word, recuse myself from voting in this particular?
I believe it's abstain from voting due to conflict of interest.
Thank you.
We have a motion. Is there a second? We have a second from John Cabot. So we have a motion and a second to recommend approval of the antler CWMU permit recommendations for 2012. All in favor? 8-4. One abstained, zero opposed.
Unless it's all landlocked.
Greg, you're up.
Public ground, private land, so there's no way for us to know. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and council members. My name is Greg Sheehan. I'm the Administrative Services Chief for Division of Wildlife from the Salt Lake office. Tonight I've got a proposed rule change. It's R657-62. It's drawing application procedures is that rule. In December of 2008, the wildlife, through the RAC process and the Wildlife Board process, several changes were considered and a few were made that addressed how we do drawings and groups and bonus points and a few things like that. All of those are still in place at this point, but excuse me, we're actually here tonight to ask you to consider eliminating one of those rules. So typically we come here with more rules for you to stack up, and tonight we're asking to do the opposite and eliminate one of those rules. And that rule is 657-62-9. It's bonus point forfeiture. And essentially the rule says if someone goes three consecutive years without applying for a big game, limited entry, or once in a lifetime hunt or bonus point, all of his or her big game bonus points are erased. So that's what that rule, it's not much longer than what I've got written here. Some of the intentions when that went through, just for the record, that was one of many options that the division presented through the RAC and board processes as changes. So it wasn't really an obscure thing that came out of nowhere, but when we presented that, we had a few objectives, I guess. One was clean up records by getting non-participants out of the pool, if you will. Another one is we said, well, these people aren't contributing annually, they're not buying licenses, why should we let them keep these things? And then there was some belief that maybe that would reduce competition or improve odds a little bit. Now that a few years have passed and it's time to actually erase those points, and we've not done that yet, we've learned a little bit more and contemplated a few more things, and I'll go through these, and they're basically the reasons why we're recommending at this point that we eliminate the rule. First of all, are potential legal complications. If we've given people appropriate notice is one thing that we've talked about, but another thing is for many years we've sold people a bonus point who just wanted to pay their $5 in the past or now $10. And buy a point, and they had some expectation of future use for that point. So our concern is, you know, did these people buy this thing thinking that they might have something useful in the future? We also had a belief that many non-participants or people who aren't applying are not really active contributors. So we look at it now, we found out a large percent of those people are still buying other hunting opportunities with us. Jumping ahead down further on the slide, the number of people that we're talking about eliminating all of their points tonight is about 95,000 people. There's about just over 300,000 people, right at about 300,000 people in our whole system who have points. So we're looking at taking about one out of three people and saying we're erasing all of your points. Earlier tonight, you know, we've heard a lot of comments from the public saying, you know, don't hurt our efforts to keep people involved and don't take away some of these things we're trying to do. Yet we would take one in three people. Some of these people have as many as 16 points, bonus points that we'd erase. And in the last few years, we've had a poor economy. Maybe people haven't had the resources to be, you know, buying a hunting license and applying for points. Or maybe, you know, people have been gone for work reasons or church reasons or other things that maybe haven't had them involved. So I guess that, you know, we're just not really sure that this is buying us a lot of goodwill out there. It's something that we feel like doesn't gain us much. The next item we've got on here, odds not improved. You know, the people who still aren't going to apply, it's not going to change anybody else's odds anyway. So that's really not a factor. The cost, if we're going to do this, we at least need to do a notification to those people so they can have a last chance to apply. And based on the number of mailings that we have to do and other notifications, it's going to cost about $70,000 to contact those 95,000 people. And that would get us kind of the people from the past until now off the books. and about $5,000 a year to notify new people who would fall into this category. So there's a cost, and I guess the question for you is, it's not really buying us much. Is that really where our wildlife dollars, wildlife management dollars are best spent, and spending a lot of money just to erase people's bonus points that are out on the books? And then the last item I've got on the list here is negative impact on hunter retention. You know, if this is the kind of thing that we're doing to folks, are they really going to want to keep participating down the road? And, you know, we go in and a guy's got however many 10 points and we erase them off the books. And, you know, does that individual really want to try to get involved again? And it's going to start all over and applying for points or doing things. And it's not costing us a penny to keep these people on our records right now. And in fact, as I mentioned, the inverse, if we try to get them off our records, it is going to cost us money. So in summary, our recommendation tonight is that we eliminate that bonus point forfeiture section. And I think that's all. Thank you.
Sorry, Greg, I was a little distracted there. But
that's okay.
Are there any questions from the public on the agenda item? Seeing none, questions from the council? Russ.
Greg, you know, I agree with you here. You know, I think it's a good move on the division's part, but I guess there's really no way to know how many people there may have died already. And
some of those may have died. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we mail postcards out and reminders for these different draws, and so we do get a fair number of people who, family members who may contact us and say, hey, this person's deceased, quit mailing us stuff. So we do take those people off out of the system when we're aware of those and can verify those. The people who are deceased, or maybe someone applied a couple times and moved far away and they're never going to do it again, or maybe a family member. So fine, they're not hurting anything. We'll just leave them out there, and it's not costing us anything to have them in our database. So,
any other questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to the public. Is there anybody from the public who'd like to comment on this agenda item? Okay. Comments and or motions from the council. Jim?
Hooray, that's my comment. It's about time. This was one of the craziest things we ever did, and I remember when we did it, and I objected to it and fought it and didn't win. But so I win one, even though belatedly. I move that we approve this rescinding of this rule.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion from Jim Gaskell and a second from Paul Cowley to recommend approval of the bonus point rule amendments R657-62-9. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
9 in favor, 0 opposed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and council members.
Thank you, Greg. Is Brent Paul here or a representative of the Paul Enterprises? So, the Poles were proposing to have their property closed to rifle deer hunting, and they're not here to make their proposal. And I'd just like to table the agenda item. Jim?
So are you making the motion, or do you want me to?
I can't make a motion.
Okay, I move that we table it until we have someone present the information. Scott's name's on the list, but I don't see Scott.
But Scott's actually presenting the division's position. Okay. So
I made the motion.
Okay, is there a second? Craig? Okay, we have a motion and a second, or discussion on the motion. Okay, so We have a motion and a second to table the Paul rifle deer hunting closure proposal. All in favor? 9-4, 0 opposed. Thank you very much. So we're probably right in there with the fastest racks as far as getting this completed, and I really appreciate you guys being on the ball this week. So, yes, Jim.
I just have a question. Will this then come up in the Wildlife Board, and if so, what will our tabling accomplish? I think it was a good idea, but I still want it. It's an administrative question. Maybe Ernie knows.
My understanding, and I think everyone's understanding, is they would be here to present their proposal. So without that happening, I don't think it will be on the Wildlife Board's agenda.
That's correct. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Motion to adjourn. Paul, so moved.
Second.
You know that.